Thank you, Jack. What I'm going to talk about is just a collection, a melange of theoretical concepts and ideas of relevance to this general topic. I'm going to be focusing, though, on Neptunes, sub-Neptunes, and super-Earths, their structures, evolution, including mass loss, looking at transit spectra, emission spectra, et cetera. And I'm glad that I followed Heather's wonderful talk summarizing the basics of what we know from the photometry and spectroscopy for even larger objects getting down into the Neptune and sub-Neptune range. Of course, this theoretical work was done in collaboration, and I want to highlight Alex Howe and David Spiegel in particular for contributions that I'm going to be presenting today. People have seen a number of the slides that I'm going to be showing, or at least I'm showing variations. This is the before and after, and I'm just amazed at this yellow hive, this collection. And it's, of course, these objects that is the focus of this conference. The first thing I want to talk about is what a Neptune might look like in transit. We were told a little bit in Heather's talk about the importance of albedos as a function of wavelength and planet-star flux ratios. So I'm going to look at some theoretical models of Neptunes in this regard. This is the pressure that you penetrate to. Is an example here of GJ 436b, a model, of course, from 1 to 10 microns and beyond, as a function of wavelength. And you see that in the standard default models, and that depends quite a bit on whether they're clouds and these sorts of things and how thick they are, in those standard models, you probe a very large range of pressures from 10 to the minus 4 bars to a bar. It's very unlike stellar atmospheres, where the range of pressures that are probed is fairly small. So in principle, you're sampling a wide range of the atmosphere. And this is an interesting aspect. Some of the results that one can come to, though, are summarized here. And again, I'm going to be going fairly quickly and leaving, because this is KITP, a lot of the details to the discussion after the talk. This is some results for HAT-P11B and GJ436B as a function of various parameters of the redistribution of heat from the day to the night side, et cetera. And you can see the types of albedo spectra that we would expect, where the albedo is up near two-thirds or on that order would be the largest you could get. But you have characteristic behavior versus wavelength in the optical that bespeak the character of the atmospheres. These are low resolution, and of course, the higher the resolution, in principle, the more information. And that's something for the future, but this is just to give you an idea. Of course, the simple default models give you much larger reflectivity in principle at the shorter wavelengths. But it's also the case that for these irradiated objects close in, unlike Neptune and Uranus, you're going to get a significant amount of flux at the longer wavelengths, still shortwards of 1 micron. And this is from thermal emission. And from observations, you really can't distinguish reflection from emission, except in polarization. That's an interesting issue. And so the concept of albedo is a little bit challenged, but if you just define it as normally, you would get this increase at these wavelengths here. And that's because of the proximity. One can also calculate planet-star flux ratios at secondary eclipse, and again, for those who aren't following this on a daily basis, Heather's introduction of the distinction between secondary and primary eclipse is very useful and certainly carries over to this. And you can see what types of numbers we're talking about. We're talking about a few times 10 to the minus 4 ratios up to about 10 to the minus 3. For giant planets, you can get up to almost 10 to the minus 2. And so you can see the distinction that radius introduces. Now, you can also look at the pressure-temperature profiles. Again, these are default simple models as a function of distance from the central star. In this case, it's a G2 star. You can do this for a variety of stars. And again, these are theoretical models. What's being compared are two things. This is as you go inward in orbital radius from 0.5 AU to 0.03 AU. Of course, you get hotter and hotter. But you can also do this as a function of metallicity. Or opacities in the atmosphere, how many heavy elements, which generally contribute significantly to the optical depths, what that dependence is. And you can see that the dependence is not that extreme from this curve to this curve, this curve to this curve, this curve to this curve, et cetera. So that metallicity is a secondary characteristic It's a difficult thing to measure. Now, they're also for general Neptune models. If you took a Neptune, for example, and you put it at these close-in distances, these are the types of pseudo-albedos that you would get. Again, we're in the optical or the CCD optical, and you get significant at these closer-in distances. You get significant flux in the longer wavelengths. At higher temperatures, again, for the planet atmosphere, you're going to have the high flux here. But higher temperatures, by default, will also give lower fluxes at the shorter wavelengths. And so you see at large distances, this is high and this is low. And at close distances, this is low and this is high. And that's a characteristic, generally, of these types of dependences on distance. There's complications, of course, because of the unknown characters of clouds, which is, again, bedeviling the subject, but is a central aspect of the future. These are planet-star flux ratios, again, as a function of distance, but notice this is also as a function of metallicity. And you see there's very little difference as a function of metallicity in these models, and of course there could be other models as well. These are in the mid-infrared to near-infrared, and these are mostly water features. But the differences between the metallicity, you have to reprocess what you're absorbing in emission independent of what your metallicity is. So the total integrals have to be about the same. And that's an important consideration. And so it's just a matter of the redistribution, not the integral under the curve. And the redistribution is from the optical mostly to the mid-infrared. And you barely see that effect there. So it's very difficult to get abundances. And it puts a premium on the best spectral resolutions. This just says the same sort of thing as a function of host star, where we're using GJ436b as an example, putting it at its current distance around its star, but changing the type of star. And you can see how the albedos change quite significantly. Again, albedo is just the connected to the ratio of the planet flux to the stellar flux in the optical. And so there are distinct predictions and characteristics as a function of star as well. Now I want to go back, and early in the conference, of course, this was very well introduced by a number of speakers. And again, I apologize for showing very similar diagrams. But just look at structural models of super-Earths. Many people have addressed this, and of course the major inputs are the equations of state that are employed. And there are a variety of equations of state that are used. These are just lists here. These are basically fits. There's a Sesame, there's the Birch-Moynihan, there's the Vinay. There are a variety of different approaches. And these are rather primitive. But you get a whole collection. And then you have to, of course, nest these components. You could either have undifferentiated planets with various compositions, or you could have, which is certainly in the solar system context, you could have the differentiated planets. And it makes a difference, slight differences in the mass radius relation, et cetera. And that needs to be incorporated. But it's important to assemble these data. We've assembled, this is an older version, but for various materials. And if you want to do silicon carbide and this sort of thing, we can include this. Generally, the mantle will be a combination of these two, a perovskite component and a magnesium oxide or similar component. And then the iron in the core. There are other things just for jollies. Just to show the comparison, at least as is in the literature now, and there are better ways of looking at this, of the equations of state for various assumptions, you can show these various curves. And this is for olivine and enstatite, different approaches and approximations. But you can see there's still a variation depending on what material you assume and what approximations you assume. In the pressure-density relation that could be on the order of 50% at various densities, particularly at large densities. The empirical data, the experimental data for each individual assumption composition is fairly good. You have their densities, you have their low-density compressibilities, moduli, and so there are tie points in these curves. But as you get to higher pressures and densities, things aren't so good until you get to very high pressures and densities, alluded to earlier by Dave, where you start getting degenerate, and the Thomas-Fermi model might be a useful endpoint. Remember, here are also comparisons of the radius, the consequent radius-mass relations. for iron, for a representative olivine, and for water. And you see the deviations are significant when you start to get between the different approaches, when you start to get to about 10 Earth masses. And those deviations can be on the order of, I would say, if you do the best job, it could be as much as 5% in the radius-mass relation. And that's a detail. Another thing that was mentioned earlier about thermal corrections, there are two types of thermal corrections. One is the temperature will determine the phase, and that determines the density in no small measure. There aren't too many ambiguities there, but that's an issue. And it also, of course, it's the thermal expansion. And that could give you a 1%, certainly, depending on the phase in which you're looking and the actual thermal profiles, that could give you a 1% correction, which may not be small if we're lucky in the next 10 years or more to get the data that would be necessary. If you artificially just say that there are certain ambiguities, this is a little misleading, but it's approximately ignorance in the pressure by on the order of 7 to 10%, a little bit more, then these are the types of differences you get in the radius mass relation for just condensed condensed planets. These are single species without cores, mantles, or that type of structure, just these individual components. And you can see these differences are could be on the order of, I think this is a little bit of an exaggeration, but almost as much as 10% as you get to larger masses. So leaving that aside, because I don't think we're going to be able to distinguish these so readily and so easily because of the variety of possibilities, and that's been discussed earlier, these are just representative structural models of density versus radius and pressure versus radius as a function of the total mass, assuming an Earth-like composition of about 2-to-1 mantle to core. And I just want to call your attention to the fact that we're going to be getting up to pressures of, and this is obvious if people were looking at other people's slides, even though it wasn't always said, getting up to 50 megabars and 20 to 50 megabars for these objects. And so this is a very interesting regime that is in principle accessible experimentally. And in fact, there are classified numbers that can get there too. And this is just to make the point, and this has been made, that the magnesium silicate, if you don't use the common core mantle distribution that people have used, but just change that, and we saw that in Dave Charbonneau's talk, that has a significant, can have a significant influence in the radius mass relation. And these are just examples of changing the mantle fraction, and here's changing the amount of water in the form of ice 7, and you can get very large variations, and that's been a theme, of course, of this conference, where there are objects that are up here that could have been all water planets. One thing that does distinguish these different mantlings, the different equations of state in some detail, is the moment of inertia coefficient. And the biggest thing that's different is, in fact, the difference between differentiated and undifferentiated planets. It's not impossible that the larger, in particular, the larger terrestrial planets, when you get up to 5 and 10 Earth masses, may not be differentiated, in which case the moment inertia coefficients, and these are just the coefficients of the mass times the radius squared to give you the moment inertia, are significantly different. And it's the same with the Love number, which is related, which is associated with the understanding of tidal effects. Now, these are going to be very hard to measure. But if we're ever able to do this, this is a much better discriminant of the planetary differentiation and structure than the mass-radius relation. Or it's at least as good and probably it can be better. And so people should keep that in mind, although it's going to be a difficult thing for the future. Now, we put hydrogen and helium envelopes on these, of course, and we get all sorts of interesting behaviors. And this is just to show the general theoretical trends that have been articulated and discussed earlier. When the hydrogen-helium mass fraction, let's say as a fraction of the core mass, is only about 10%, you get very large changes in the radius. So this is in units of Earth radii. That's one Earth radius right there. Very little hydrogen can make a big difference. And this is obvious, but I just wanted to show this. And these occurs for different entropies of the envelope, which is a relevant quantity because we assume, and I think rightly, that these envelopes would be fairly convective most of the way. also as a function of core mass. And you can see how this goes. Uranus, Neptune, 10 to 15% is all you need. And this shows the same sort of thing. Now, this is my version of the diagram that people have been showing for quite some time. And it has one extra little bit on it. This is radius versus total mass, of course. It goes up to 20 Earth masses. Here's 10 Earth masses. And these are various objects that have been published in the literature. These are, of course, a number of these are the Kepler-11 system. And Dave Charbonneau has argued why right now, since they're not the best measured, we should be focusing only on the best measured. And those from Dressing et al. Are shown here in this curve right there. We've been talking about that a lot. These red dots are the old measurements, and these yellow-green dots are the new measurements, including these. And you see this jump that has been much discussed. Now, if you just get rid of all those but the Dressing data, you get this curve. But I want to call your attention to that net. What that is if you assume a certain entropy, and this is going to be a function of evolution, but you can do this for different entropies for the envelope, you can read off what the envelope mass has to be by just looking at the intersection of where the data are and these curves here. This is a 0.3 Earth mass envelope. This is one Earth mass envelope. This is three Earth mass envelope. And so you could actually just read these things off, and you get the mapping between this nice grid and this distorted grid, which you can superpose. So it's a useful general way of looking at this. And this is an Earth-like core for comparison. Notice these data down here. This has been a subject of a lot of controversy, of course. This is very, very unlikely to be real. And some of these may not even be measurements. But that's to be considered. This is, if you look at this type of mapping, just look at what these red dot grids give you, you can get approximately, and this is approximate, the percentage mass in hydrogen and helium as a function of the radius of the object. Here's approximately Uranus and Neptune. This is one Earth radius. And you get, for these particular data, and this is just all these points, in fact, you get some sort of curve that looks a little bit like this. And while I think that the numbers are going to vary a bit, you get the basic idea that as the radius increases, the percentage of hydrogen and helium increases in a particular way, which you can read off the curves. And you certainly have objects that are 10% hydrogen and helium.
So this is just assuming a one Earth-like core?
No, this is fitting the core. This is actually doing all that. This is for a particular average entropy, and we've done it as a function of entropy.
Can you remind me what the colors are?
The colors let me think what the colors were. I'm not sure exactly what the colors were. They're not the same as these colors. I don't know right now.
Is that low green point that
the Kepler-11? That's over here. we didn't want to judge the wonderful work done by the observers in all their particulars when just throwing these points on this curve. So what we did was we didn't say that this just doesn't seem possible. But we just put this on. Yeah. In this particular case, yes, but it doesn't make that much difference. It doesn't make that much difference. I think these curves over here, you could change things by almost 50%. Over here, I think similarly. But the basic trend, I think, is going to be pretty robust. And the question is whether you have a lot of them that are 40% at this radius, hydrogen, helium. But it certainly is going up like that. And 10%, I think, is there are going to be objects that are certainly more than 10%. And that's pretty rock solid. This is just a subset of those looking at the envelope fraction, the mass fraction, is a function of stellar insulation in solar units. This is one, of course, this is 1,000. There's a bit of scatter over here, and of course, these are all at different distances, different ages, but there's nothing over here. And this is at large numbers. So it brings me to trying to do these, look at these objects evolutionarily. Because what we're catching, of course, is just a snapshot. We have to really know the age. We'd have to know a lot about, we'd have to know the initial radius of the planet. We'd have to know its migration history. All these sorts of things are difficult. But throwing caution to the winds, because this is preliminary theory in advance of new data, We've done evolutionary calculations of super-Earths and mini-Neptunes, looking at the atmospheres, including atmosphere code, as a boundary condition. And so these are pseudo-real atmospheres, as a function of core mass and envelope mass, orbital distance, metallicity, and including evaporative mass loss, with a prescription that we've inherited from the simplest literature. This is just energy-limited loss associated with the ultraviolet history of the central star. And this has to be changed. And so what I'm going to say in that regard is going to be contingent on the viability and accuracy of that particular approximation, which means that it's not that valid, but is indicative. And so what you get for a particular object in this particular, the solid curve, is for a 20% envelope mass. This is for a total mass of 8 Earth masses at 0.2 AU. You see all these sorts of things. Starting out with an initial radius of 10 Earth radii, you get these types of evolutionary curves as a function of time. And this is pressure versus radius, and you can see the radius shrinking. And this is without evaporation. It's just examples. And then this is for a much smaller envelope, and smaller envelopes shrink much more quickly. And you can just see this as a function of time. And people can look at this at their leisure when this is on the web. And I'll just go through very quickly some of these curves, and don't worry about the smattering of lines, but this is the envelope mass versus time. This is 10 to the, this is a giga year right here. This is 100 mega years. And just look at the following. This is for a given envelope mass fraction. And then this is as a function, let's look at this one, as a function of core mass. And as this is large core mass, smaller core mass, smaller core mass, smaller core mass still. And you can see that as the core masses are smaller, the envelope will evaporate more quickly. And this is rather obvious because of the gravitational potential wells assumed. But you can have core masses that will retain a good fraction of the hydrogen. And this is at a given distance of 0.1 AU. So you see all the combinations of parameters that are necessary in order to do a given calculation. So again, this is a function of core mass, and this is different envelope fractions. Small envelope fraction evaporates more quickly. Larger core mass will make the evaporation, will retard the evaporation. And then you can do this for a variety of distances and fractions and core masses. These are the same, these aren't quite the same curves, but it's the same evolutionary sequence. And this is versus radius. And you just.
Why is there an inflection at 100 million years? Are you assuming something about the history of
the. Yes, yeah, that's the history of the UV flux. And
you just said something changes at 100 million.
We've just taken from what they say in the literature for UV on average. It's not bulletproof. In fact, it's probably wrong, but it is connected with a certain model for the evaporation that relies on something that has a history that is constrained reasonably well for stars, but there are a lot of ifs along the way. And that's why I say the actual evaporation model is a key unknown in some sense in this, and this gives you some representative results given assumptions. The data are supposed to tell us collectively whether we're on the right track at all. And so this is just preliminary to the assembly of a much larger data set. And this is the same sort of thing. These are again, that's for one particular envelope mass of one Earth masses, and this is a function of distance. And so you can see that at larger distances, you retain the hydrogen. At smaller distances, you do not. And as Dave points out, there's this, not quite an inflection, but there is this characteristic time at around 1 to 300 million years for these. And you can see that at 0.07 AU, you're already starting to evaporate on a reasonable time scale a lot of your envelopes. Same sort of thing, but this is for 10 Earth masses. The other thing was 5 Earth mass cores. When I say core in this particular case, this is a differentiated core mantle structure with the Earth composition with that total mass. You can also do this as a function of Z, the metallicity, and you can see at large metallicities, that's these curves here, it retards the loss to some degree of the envelopes, but qualitatively it doesn't make a huge difference. And so I'm not sure exactly whether we can say much about this. Of course, the mass loss prescription is much more important, but there is a metallicity dependence because it depends on the rate with which you could lose heat from the envelope, and that's slower for the higher metallicity models. We've seen curves like this before. This is for GJ1214b with a radius of about 2.5 Earth radii. And these are just transit spectra. And these were the models that were expected. And these are the data that people have gotten. And Heather gave a nice summary that included these sorts of data. This one for from Creedberg et al, wonderful data set. We saw that for 436b as well. And things are fairly flat. And in my estimation, and I think that was the general conclusion earlier, what this is indicating is that there are clouds, there are condensates in the atmospheres of unknown nature that are flattening out these curves, and that really need to be understood. And we see the indications of exactly this sort of these sorts of species in hot Jupiters as well. So this is not a new story. We're seeing this in many, many planets, that the understanding of clouds is almost tantamount to the understanding of the spectra of these objects. So we have our work cut out for us. But the data are indicating that it's going to be worthwhile. Now, the reason I mentioned those sets of data is that we can also do this as a function of time. And so there's theoretical models, and these are without clouds, but clouds can easily be put in here, of the transit depth versus wavelength. This is going out to 10 microns. Can be calculated. And so you go from the red curve, if you start out with some initial radius, and we don't know what the initial radii are. You let it evolve, and you can see it, even without mass loss, you can see the radius shrink in a measurable way, in principle. And these are, half a percent is over here. And so these are accessible. These are two different curves. This is at 0.1 AU, so the atmosphere is hotter than at 0.3 AU, and hotter means the larger scale height. And so you can see these differences pretty straightforwardly. And so it brings me to sort of a summary slide that includes the evaporation given this prescription for a variety of metallicities, for a variety of core masses, for a variety of envelope masses as a function of time. And so you can see it's very easy to interpret this. There's the solid curve that would be for that particular total mass if there were no envelope given a terrestrial model. And these are at different orbital distances from 0.07 AU to 0.3 AU. The large distance, you get a curve of radius versus mass for a given fraction. In this case, it's 1% envelope fraction. That's the radius. And then as the as you go from 4.3 AU, if you go from 100 megayears to 5 gigayears, you go from that red curve to that red curve. And so this is an evolutionary sequence in the radius versus mass relation. You can see how you're peeling off this large radius. Those objects at small core masses at later times can't retain their hydrogen for these distances, given this mass loss prescription. And so as a function of time, here's that olive curve, and here's the later olive curve, and you can see it peeling off. The green curve and the green curve, you can see it peeling off. Even at 100 megayears, these objects were bared. And so you can see a wave of decrease in radius moving through this plot, and in some sense a wave of revelation of the core that I think is going to be a robust conclusion in this subject, that indeed, quite sensibly, there are going to be objects that are going to be revealed in time, even if they start out with significant hydrogen envelopes. And this is the difference between these two curves. Just this is 2%, and this is 1%. And I just showed where 52i Cancri E is on here. And so in principle, these sorts of diagrams, and moving these as well, which we do have, would be useful in getting a sense of how we can actually fit these data. These are the dressing data, again, jumping up here. So you can get these curves, et cetera, try to explain some of these objects. And this is a function of time, mass loss prescription, core mass, metallicity to some degree, orbital separation, which you can read off here, will tell you at 5 giga-years exactly what total mass will be bared, given these assumptions. And so with this general soupçon of theoretical topics, I'll open up things for questions. Thank you very much for your patience.
Thank you, Adam. We'll begin with Dave.
So you were careful to say that you thought your evaporation model might be inadequate, but I'm curious as to whether you think that you see already in your attempt to fit the data that it's seriously wrong, because I could imagine ways in which it might be, having to do with loading the atmosphere with other constituents or material coming out of the interior, as distinct from this particular issue of how to treat the UV flux and so forth. And in particular, you showed the diagram, admittedly highly idealized, of a specific entropies, and you put the data on it. I'm wondering whether you can already tell from the data that this kind of modeling is not working, because we do see some planets that appear to have a relatively small hydrogen envelope, and you would have thought that would get stripped away quickly.
That's a good question. We haven't looked at it in sufficient detail. What you have to do is also try to factor in an age and a metallicity and a distance. The distance we have, but I'm not sure that we can conclude robustly that the general conclusions that I've articulated here are incorrect. So I would think that this curve, for example, go back, that curve, is not going to be off by more than a factor of two. And I'm just trying to show the trend. Okay, I'm going to find out what these colors are. I'm sorry, Natalie.
Okay, but you've got some points there down at a fraction of a percent. Aren't those going to lose their envelope so quickly that you would not have expected to see many points in that range? I guess that's what I'm curious about.
I don't know yet. I'm not going to.
Yes, I have a question and about a comment. For the very beginning of your talk, we talked about the equations of state. And since there's a mineral physicist in the room, can you go back to your big table at the very beginning, slide seven or something? Yeah, this one. So basically, the feedback I should give here, it's not important whether you have a Vinay or third-order equation of Biot-Schmirnwain fit. The important part is that these things were all constructed fit to diamond anvil cell experiments, and they're very, very accurate in the regime where the experiments were performed. So a table where the pressure regime where they performed, let's say from 1 GPa to 80 GPa, in some cases to 200 GPa, is the most relevant quantity. Beyond that, it's extrapolated.
Absolutely.
If you do extrapolation, you should not even think about using Thomas Fermi-Dirac. That is a theory. It's 100 years ago. It doesn't know anything about bonds. The atoms are individual quantities. They know nothing about the other atoms.
I was extrapolating that to 1,000 terabars. Asymptotically, it's going to work.
The comment I want to give is...
So it's a tie point, not a good one.
If I want any pressure you're interested for planetary science can easily be addressed with density functional theory. And the calculation for a solid only takes like a minute on your laptop.
So why haven't you done it for me?
Oh, look at our paper 2014. There's a big correction for silicon carbide, which has an empty line in your table. It has been revised for solid iron. Carbon is done. We looked at some structures. There are some revisions. If you look for them, you'll find them. So they're not accurate.
No, I agree. I don't think they're accurate enough. These are what's been used to do these models. We get the Earth, for example, to about 2%. That's not necessarily good for some communities, but it's okay, as far as I'm concerned right now, for the exoplanet work. But eventually, it's going to be important to get these equations to stay better. Unfortunately, as I mentioned here, these pressure ranges are very large, and we'd like to be able to get empirical data in these ranges, and those are few and far between. So your point's very well taken.
Okay.
Dave, and then we're going to go to Laura.
So I just wanted to ask a question about your final plot. So just so I understand what you're doing here, the picture is that you have a fully differentiated rock and iron core, and then
right. There's
a hydrogen helium envelope. So there's no icy mantle. This is not a Neptune.
No. I mean, we've done the calculations with icy mantles, too. That doesn't change things qualitatively.
Well, but it's. I mean, what's interesting, of course, is, you know, if this is the story...
If it were all ice, it does change things. If
right, but when you expose the core... So what you're saying is you expose the core, and the core is rock. So there, and that's what we are seeing in these points. They are much more dense than they would be if they were actually the cores of Neptune at the same mass.
Yeah.
They would be much puffier.
Yeah.
I don't see that. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. There are just too many parameters. This is a representative set of calculations, and I'm just trying to show the general type of evolution you'd expect as it unwraps.
Right. But I mean, taking this a step further, your picture for the formation of these objects is they're forming inside the snow line. So you're somehow...
No, I'm just assuming certain structures. I'm not saying where they formed and how they migrated.
But these must have formed. I mean, you would form a rocky body. It would be massive enough that then it would accrete hydrogen in situ.
I think so, because it's looking rocky over here. That's certainly the case. But I think that this is still an open question. It is true, though, that there's an awful lot more ice beyond the snow line. There was an awful lot more material out of which you could form cores, such as Uranus and Neptune, such as perhaps the cores of Jupiter and Saturn, than rocky material. So there may well be objects that, like mini Uranuses and Neptunes that are formed beyond the snow line, that migrate in. They could still retain some hydrogen and are going to be affected by the irradiation, and you're going to peel this off, and you're going to reveal things that are ice-like and not rock-like or rock iron-like. And I think that's your point.
Yeah, I think Adam's doing basically minimalist models. You have two constituents you know you need. Yeah, but just to the rocky and the gas component, because some must have gas, and you have an ambiguity with things in the middle.
There's one thing I do want to emphasize before I go to whatever questions there are to follow, is that with mass loss, you're talking about winds, too. And it's possible that we've already seen winds coming off of hot Jupiters. WASP-12b, HD-209-458b, HD-189-733b all have measured winds with mass loss rates that can be estimated. It's been a subject from the beginning of exoplanets, when people were worried about whether 51 Peg B could survive so close to the central star and there would be a wind. But the numbers turned out to be okay. And so it's in principle possible that, as we've seen from giant planets, sub-Neptunes and Neptunes could have winds that are measurable. And the way they've been measured for hot Jupiters is, in fact, in the ultraviolet. Because in the ultraviolet, the cross sections are so large, you don't need a very large aerial column to get a large optical depth. And so your transit will give you a much larger transit radius. For example, for HD-209-458b, the optical radius is 1.36, 1.32 Jupiter radii. In the ultraviolet, it's about 4.5 Jupiter radii, and that's beyond the Roche lobe. So that indicated a wind from the beginning, and there was some controversy, et cetera. But there's huge difference in the radius. You're going to get the same thing for the Neptunes and the sub-Neptunes. And we may be able to measure from those sizes and some modeling what the densities are, and be able to work backwards to get test the mass loss models. So that's just something to keep in mind.
Lauren?
Hi, I'm Lauren Weiss from UC Berkeley. I'd just like to say that excluding the low mass and small planets is giving you an incomplete picture of mass loss. For instance, you noted earlier that you chose to exclude the Kepler-11 planets because their masses are not detected at high significance.
Well, no. I chose to listen to Dave and Courtney in that regard. But I can keep an open mind if...
Yes, please listen to me. Listen to me right now. Listen.
I'm not ignoring them. I'm ignoring them in the sense. of the second question, second speaker.
Right. So that was my statement, and I guess what I would say about that is, just because their masses are detected at low significance does not mean that we have not determined that they are low mass planets. In fact, we have very strong upper limits on the masses of the Kepler-11 planets. And so we do know that there are planets of two Earth masses that have rather inflated radii, like two Earth radii. And so those aren't showing up on your plot.
Not on that plot. Yeah, that's true.
Right, they're here, but they're not on your final evolutionary plot.
That's true.
And I think it's...
That's not a final plot, that's a representative plot.
What I'd like... It's not. That's my point.
It's an example plot.
Yeah. So what I'm asking is, how does your story about mass loss include the Kepler-11 planets? If I say, apply your story to these planets that we have detected and for which we know they have a large component of their mass in hydrogen-helium envelopes, how do they fit into your story?
That's a good point. Again, I was focusing on these for the reasons articulated in the by the second speaker of the conference. But now include these. Okay, fine. This will depend on the character of the central star and their orbital separations. And so I can go back and do the calculations with these as well in mind and see what types of constraints on the mass loss prescription might be necessary. I just caution that, again, there may be some ambiguities. There are certainly ambiguities in these objects here. And so I've seen over the last few decades, in my looking at this particular subject, that the data change. The theory changes as well, but the data change quite a bit as well. So I'm just being conservative.
There are other planets that don't make it onto this plot, because even though they're less than 10 Earth masses, very clearly less than 10 Earth masses, they're more than 5 Earth radii. There's Kepler 79d and Kepler 51 b and c, ultra low density. So the Kepler 11 are not that anomalous. Kepler 33 are very similar. There's several others. So individually, you have some ambiguity in terms of the mass, but even 36C is pretty high up there.
Yeah, no. Assuming that, of course, those will survive. It's fine. Okay, fine.
No,
I got that. So then we can assume that it would be good to go back and check for those stars, for those distances, what type of core masses might be necessary, et cetera, because there still could be ambiguities in the masses.
But there's no ambiguity on the mass upper limits. The question is, are they 1 or 2 Earth masses, not are they 2 or 10 Earth masses?
I'll go over for those particular orbital numbers, what the constraints they can put on the mass loss. What I will say is that it's going to be very hard not to have significant mass loss from this population of planets. The numbers that you're going to get are going to vary, and I said that from the very beginning.
Right, but that's exactly the problem, because we can observe that these planets have a large percentage of their mass in hydrogen and helium.
You can get that from here.
They have to.
Straightforwardly. Well, I'm going to keep an open mind on the migration.
We haven't solved, right? Dave's question was kind of like that. These planets that are smaller than 5 Earth radii are in your mass loss diagram. You were assuming they formed in situ.
No, but they have to get there early on. You can't migrate them in late. Very, very useful point that Lauren's making, I think, is what she's
saying, is that it would be extremely productive to see if you can reconcile a model like this with objects like Kepler-11. These are clearly sort of touchstone objects that the models will stand or fall.
Sure. The evaporation depends on, again, the prescription for the evaporation, the ultraviolet flux in this particular case, the ages. There are a variety of things that come into this, the metallicities as well. And so I think it would be good to see whether there's some wiggle room in some of this. But it's going to be very hard, again, to suppress evaporation that for some of these planets is going to be significant. And this is and these calculations are an attempt to at least to get that going.
We're going to have, we have one quick question of someone who's been had her hand up for a long time, and then we're going to have to move on.
Just curiosity, Adam, this plot, does that take into account the stellar variability in the first million years, like flaring and magnetic activity?
No.
Because are you sure that this is less important than what you are doing now?
It would just make it more extreme.
Yeah, but does that screw up the whole plot or not? I'm just wondering about orders of magnitude here.
Yeah, I mean, it would make things worse in principle, but this is just depending on the initial radius, all these other parameters, and we'll see whether things can work out sensibly. But you're not going to be able to suppress evaporation. We already see it from giant planets which have deeper potential wells, and I think that you're going to see it from these as well. Yeah. Yeah. And that's empirical, but that's a good point. I don't want to be too brash about it.
But we're going to have to move on. We're out of time. So let's thank Adam again.